on a scenario without siren radio. Sound up everyone, save a siren sound.
Siren radio.
Come Lincoln to Miami, Paris to LA. Our global community wants to hear it play. Students participate, keep on keeping on, keep on keeping on.
Siren Radio.
Keep on keeping on.
Siren Radio.
Keep on keeping on.
Siren Radio.
Keep on keeping on. Say Siren Radio.
Now, if I said the words planning for death, you might automatically be reaching for the retune button, the off switch, or move to something completely different. But no, please stick with us, because the next few moments will prove hopefully not just insightful, but also provide you with some useful items to consider thinking about, given that the most certain things in life are indeed taxes and death. But in terms of that, we're delighted to actually welcome, referring to this Co-op Planning for Death report, a legend, genuine legend of history. It's the fabulous Louise Minchin. How are you, Louise?
Oh, thank you so much. I'm good. And I'm, yeah, I mean, we're not talking about the most upbeat subject, but I think it's a subject we really all need to address. So, yeah, Co-op have done this State of the Nation Planning for Death report. And there's lots of things that have come out of it which have surprised me, actually. Lots of things. One in ten of us won't discuss death at all with friends and family. Despite that, almost half of people agree conversations help them prepare for it. I'm one of those one in ten until this point. I've never discussed my plans that I'd have after my, that things I'd like to happen after I've died with my family. And it's, I accept it's a really awkward conversation, but it's so important that we do that, because when somebody dies, one of the most precious things is to do what they want. So I've had that awkward conversation with my husband. I've been married 25 years. And I said to him this week, I was like, so what do you want to happen? And he said he wanted to be cremated. Honestly, I had no idea. And I was really shocked. I wouldn't have, that's not what I expected to happen. But it's really important that we do have these conversations, isn't it, Alex?
I mean, that's really at the key of the whole issue, that, you know, we don't really know. We might have different sort of aspects. We might have worked through that. We seem to have kind of lost that notion that in the Victorian era, where obviously there was a whole paraphernalia about death and so on. And there is a sense now that somehow we will live forever and so on. And we may well do in different forms. But the fact of the matter is that, yes, the end point will arrive for most of us. Of course, we don't know when. So it's important to plan ahead, presumably.
I like what you said about the don't know when as well, because you don't, do you? I mean, some people do know because they've had a diagnosis, so they do have perhaps time to plan, and, you know, that helps people open up the conversation. Some people maybe not. Maybe they still, I mean, I imagine it's still an awkward conversation to have, isn't it? But you don't know when or when it's going to happen to you or your loved ones as well. And I think just even talking about it has made me think, I don't know how many days, weeks I've got left. Let's go out there. And this is reflected in the report as well. Let's go out there. Let's enjoy it. And let's make sure that people know when something happens, that what I want to happen in, you know, at my funeral, for example. I want it to be really fun. I want them to have a really great time. And I think my family needs to know that. I'm sure they imagine that anyway.
I mean, I was intrigued to see that folk in their late teens and 20s were thinking about it more than their older counterparts. Now, I seem to recall in my teens and 20s, you kind of had a feeling of immortality, really, at that stage. The notion
really
of mortality wasn't there.
Yeah, I was really surprised by that, because like you, I just thought, you know, that I could do anything I liked and it was all going to be fine.
And of course you can, and still will be able to do for many a centuries yet, Louise, we know that.
But yeah, I was really surprised by that. But exactly that, 18 to 29 year olds consider their mortality more often than their older counterparts. And I think good on them. And what I would say, though, is not just to consider it, but also talk about it, because I worry that my children might be worried, you know, considering their mortality and not talking to me, because I think all these conversations are really important. And, you know, sharing something makes the problem half, doesn't it? Or less than half, whatever it is. And then, you know, they're the same as people over 70. So it's us lot in the middle who are refusing or shying away from these conversations. But I think we should all try and do it if we possibly can. And, you know, I mean, I've had these conversations with my family this week, and while I was shocked, they're really helpful. And they'll be really helpful on those dark and difficult days when you lose someone as well, because you know what their plan was.
Louise, you're a top television presenter, you're an ace journalist, a fabulous author, you're an excellent communicator. The key thing, obviously, is communication. What would you say, what advice would you give to somebody who's listening to this who might well say, yeah, it's all very well for Louise to actually say this. Yeah. She's a complete professional in these things. How do I start? Do you sit somebody down and say, let's talk about death?
No. Well, I'd just say, how would I start? I mean, I started this conversation last week going, I literally turned around to my husband and said, right, okay, so what do you want to happen? But I don't think that's the way in, is it? I mean, maybe the way in
it's a possible way in, but yeah, who knows?
It was very eye-opening. Better ways in. Have a cup of tea and say, I've just been thinking about what my plans might be. Maybe that's the way in. Have a thought yourself, and then open up with conversation with volunteering what your plans might be, and then see what the other people's are as well. You don't have to go in, so how do you want to?
Exactly.
A bit more gentle than I was.
it's a wee bit like ripping the Band-Aid off, basically. And somebody's saying, okay, right, let's move into this then.
Yeah. And it's also other really important things as well. So, you know, lots of us have not made our wills. And, you know, that's really important from a legal point of view to make it easier for your family when you've gone. I have done a will. I did it many years ago when I first bought a house. And now all these things are moving on later in life. You know, people are buying their houses later in life, probably doing wills later in life. But, you know, that is a very important thing to get in place, especially for your family, for their future as well.
As we said, this has emerged from the Co-op Planning for Death report. If people wish to actually find out further details about the Co-op, or indeed possibly wish to actually look at what funeral plans might be on offer for them, where would you point them?
They search up Co-op on the internet, co-op.co.uk, and there's lots of information which will hopefully make the conversations a little bit easier and signpost you places to go as well.
And anything from your own perspective, Louise, vis-a-vis your upcoming books, novels, anything else you'd like to just give a plug to?
Alex, thank you so much. What can I tell you? So my last book, which was out last year, is called Fearless Adventures with Extraordinary Women. And I really was enjoying life as much as I possibly could. I went and did lots of different things with brilliant women who are breaking boundaries in sport, including climbing mountains, free diving under ice. That was absolutely brilliant. And I'm super excited because I've written a thriller that's coming out in September, and it's called Isolation Island. I think it's going to be, I think you'll like it. It's about a reality TV show that's gone wrong.
Yeah, well, that. It's like Hunger Games mixed with, you know, real life documentaries.
Yes, it is. You've got it in one.
Louise, it's been awesome connecting with your good self as ever. I take it you've had a reasonably interesting Zoomer with us on the program today.
An interesting what?
Zoomer. The kind of technology we use to actually use the medium of Zoom to connect. I refer to it as Zoomers. It's just that.
I love Zoom. Well, yeah, I mean, it's changed our lives, hasn't it?
Well, absolutely. And we've even spoken about death as well in a way that hopefully opens up a whole range of positive lines from that point of view.
I think it's a really good thing to do.
Can we prevail upon you to rejoin us when you're talking about your book later on in the year? Will you come back sometime?
100%. Thank you very much indeed.
The legendary Louise Minchin. We salute you. Take care now.
Take care, Alex.
Time for more movie thoughts, reviews, and royal commentary from Richard Fitzwilliams and Natasha Wanton on the Midweek Drive.
It's okay. I'm here. It's been a while since you've had one of those nightmares. Tell me, what was it about?
It's only fragments. Nothing's clear. You've been fighting the Harkonnens for decades.
Look!
My family's been fighting them for centuries.
Your blood comes from dukes and great houses. Here, we're equal. What we do for the benefit of all.
Well, I'd very much like to be equal to you.
Maybe I'll show you the way.
Deal with this prophet.
Send assassins.
Fade Rotha. He's psychotic.
I see possible futures all at once. And in so many futures, our enemies prevail. But I do see a way. There is a narrow way through. This to you. Do you believe me?
This is a form of power that our world has not yet seen. The ultimate power.
I want you to know I will love you as long as I breathe.
You will never lose me as long as you stay who you are.
Consider what you're about to do, Paul Atreides.
Silence!
Is how they enslave us!
I have to say, after seeing Dune Part 2, is put together with Part 1, it's a fine 10 out of 10. And I think actually a total of about 5 hours, 5.5 hours is probably duly does justice to Frank Herbert's classic work. I even suspect that Richard Fitzwilliams might possibly say that finally David Lean's Lawrence of Arabia desert epic has been eclipsed by the magnificent of the Sandworms, the joy of the Harkonnen-Atreides battles, and indeed the Bene Gesserit sisterhood, with, of course, a gladiator homage as well, and the ultimate joy of having Willy Wonka go head-to-head with Elvis Presley in a duel to the death. Richard, over to you.
Well, Alex, yes, it is a very, very enjoyable and successful movie. And indeed, yes, a spectacle to relish and indeed to savour. I think all myths and legends have got this timeless battle between good and evil. And here you've got futuristic mythology and, you know, it draws down on so many historical his events and so forth, and homages here and there, as you mentioned, Gladiator and so on. I mean, it is the desert sequences are simply amazing. I think directed in Villeneuve, adapting Frank Herbert's novel, drawing on ancient history, also most particularly the mesmerizing geography of the desert land of Arrakis. So in an environmentally conscious era, it certainly seems that the climate can be harnessed for the sake of change, and certainly so by one who's been the chosen one to lead his people out of the bondage, which, of course, is the people of Arrakis, the Fremen, are conquered or have been conquered by the Harkonnens. I mean, in the first of Dune 1, I mean, I think it helps to have seen that. I do think, not, I don't think it's essential, but I do think it's very, very helpful. And the aristocratic Atreides family has been betrayed by the duplicitous Emperor Shaddam IV, played by Christopher Walken. They've been granted the poison chalice of ruling the planet of Arrakis, the sole source of spice, and spice is pivotal to interstellar travel. Paul Atreides, played by Timothée Chalamet, is very much a sort of messianic super being, but who's also very troubled by his visions of future power. He joins the Fremen, the indigenous inhabitants, who are in revolt, as I mentioned, as you did, against the Harkonnens, who've destroyed and deplaced the Atreides family and are based in the capital Arrakeen. He's fallen in love with a Fremen, Chani, played by Zendaya, but she is very mistrustful of his ambitions. He's supported by Stilgar, played by Avia Bardem, and the supporters among the tribes see him as a form of a messiah. So you have a spectacular movie. You've also got a movie that's, I think it's got very wide appeal because the scale of it, the scope of it, as you correctly mentioned, it does come off. And one of the ways it does is by creating this extraordinary planet. It's got giant worms, it's got ferocious sandstorms, inhabited caves, all of this. And very fine scenes of guerrilla warfare because Paul leads the Fremen against the Harkonnens, and they have giant war machines and they have dragonfly-like helicopters, of which I was particularly fond.
Ornithopters, Richard.
They're all what? Sorry,
ornithopters. Ornithopters, not helicopters.
They look the same.
We won't argue the point because I think you'll agree that they are rather fascinating and the way they sort of buzz around. I found them very appealing in the first film and I had a fondness for them in the second. I think, excitingly, dramatically filmed, I do think one of the things I noticed with Dune 1, and it also affects Dune 2, is that it is rather dark in the way it is filmed, the camera work. It's very impressive, but it is a bit dark. I would have thought it would have had a bit more impact. At one point, Charlie talks about the sunlit uplands of Arrakis, and they're very rarely sunlit as we understand it. Also, the climactic battle is a bit confusing, but an all-star cast, very good chemistry between Paul and Charlie, which of course is uneasy as well. Timothy Chalamet and Zendaya are very well cast. And then you've got in the supporting cast Christopher Walken, Leo Seydoux, Stellan Skarsgård, Charlotte Rampling, and so it goes on. Rebecca Ferguson as Paul's mother, Florence Pugh as the alluring Princess Irulan, the Emperor's daughter, Austin Butler, not the sort of person who's terribly nice. Yes, he features in a homage to Gladiator. I'm only getting a little tired, by the way, of arenas because we had so many of them in the Hunger Games. But this is a spectacle. Uneven, yes, but irresistible.
Richard, we're heading towards an arena battle for Saving Siren Radio, so don't get tired on that sort of side of things there. I'm already actually having to bulk up on that sort of process.
Well, I have to say, it's the proper scale, fine cast, very much enjoyed, definitely 8.
Yeah, you see, this is it has to be a 10 for me. For reasons that effectively, when it comes to bodily functions and bodily fluids, Lady Jessica, although she tries to actually hold in her gagging reflex, she does actually give up some of the water of life. And you know my feelings with respect to excessive bodily functions in movies. And if you actually had to that only one minor profanity, it actually worked on a whole level. Rebecca Ferguson is probably one of those few people who can actually get me into the cinema to actually see a movie from this point of view. And Denis Villeneuve, clearly working already on the second novel, Dune Messiah, which of course technically would be Dune Part 3.
I do think it would be helpful if we didn't know that.
Well, it's out there, Richard. I mean, I could go further.
I accept it's out there, but at the preview, you could see the audience perhaps were not aware of what you've just said.
Well, again, I'm not to be held responsible for the inability of people to read a classic novel from the 1960s. Fear. Your own line on this particular thing, which was often deemed to be unfilmable. And indeed, many tried. In the words of the Bene Gesserits, they tried and failed, they tried and died in terms of the response that they actually have. But here, I think Denis Villeneuve, his third consecutive science fiction epic, after, of course, Arrival, Blade Runner 2049, and now, of course, Dune Parts 1 and Parts 2. What did you make of it, Fia? Or have you seen it? Or do you intend to go and see it?
I will be watching it this afternoon. So, good. Yeah, no, I mean, I'm one of those people who I do have the book, but I've not read it yet. But I will, especially now.
Mm, yeah, very faithful but to the whole sequence. And the agony, of course. Do you have Paul Muad'Dib? Do you actually have a small mouse? How do you actually cope with a messiah who effectively doesn't want to be the Messiah, doesn't see himself as being a Messiah, and therefore actually confirms even more that he must be the Messiah because he actually is so humble he doesn't want to be the Messiah. Natasha Wanton, as somebody who faces this task on a regular basis in Australia, any thoughts from yourself on Dune Part 2?
I haven't actually seen Part 1 yet. I know, terrible. I feel like it's
check it out on streaming.
I feel like it's going to be one of those rabbit holes that once I commit and go down it, I'm going to be stuck down that hole for some time. So I don't know if it's worth, especially because I know that there was a cliffhanger at the end of the first one, whether it's better to now watch them together now that the second part has come out. I know that I am one of those people that is, as you've heard me say many times before, a very much a stickler for the books. So if things do not link up to the books nicely, I probably wouldn't like it, which is why I'm avoiding reading the books and probably going to watch the movies first, because I feel like that would be a wiser decision. Otherwise, I would irritate myself probably unnecessarily.
It is actually very, very close to the book. There are a few very minor changes, but actually it's even closer than David Lynch's version, which I still think was a flawed masterpiece from 1984, even though David Lynch prefers not to actually think about it and maintains it was too onerous a task to try and put the thing together. And of course, I believe there was another filmmaker who also attempted to make Dune. It was regarded for many years as unfilmable, but I think we've proven here that it can be, and certainly paves the way to a whole new franchise following up Dune Messiah. There'll be Children of Dune, God Emperor of Dune. In fact, you've got at least 7 books originated by Frank Herbert and a whole stack of other goodies to actually work through. Game of Thrones, your time is up. The Emperor is basically now being replaced. End of. Long live the fighters.
We haven't, And one thing we haven't even said is, me, have you talked about the soundtrack of this? I mean, especially the first film, it's amazing. I just had to say that, I had to praise it because
Yeah,
it's
the
so
soundtrack,
good.
Hans Zimmer, also known for his score for Gladiator, certainly pulls no punches in terms of this and produces some outstanding moments. And also, sometimes less is more. The absence of any sound whatsoever, other than the grunting and groaning in the fight between, as I say, Willy Wonka and Elvis Presley, Timothy Chalamet and Austin Butler, Fade Rauta, of course, taking on board Paul Atreides. It actually makes for a much more visceral experience. So again, I think Denis Villeneuve has actually once again scored a perfect 10. Put the two movies together. If you saw them separately, it might be 9, 9.5, etc. Collectively, a bit like Avengers Endgame and the precursor to Infinity War, etc. Yeah, see them both together, it gets a 10.
I'm very impressed with it. I think it's a fantastic series. Also, you mentioned Arrival, Alex, and I just wanted to put thumbs up to that one, which that for me would be a 9 or a 10. A wonderful film.
Yeah, so there we are. Speculation continues and demonstrates quite clearly that you don't have to swear throughout. Unfortunately, Richard's next choice of movie contains copious amounts of swearing and indeed libel and a whole stack of other things to the extent that we probably can't even run a clip of the movie because there's so much robust industrial language on this apparently real case that's focused in Littlehampton and deals with basically nasty little letter writers. Even though Olivia Colman, not known for swearing like a trooper, clearly actually does so in this particular instance.
Well, I have to say, Alex, that if you don't run a clip, you're missing very little because this is a bad film, and it is a great pity because, obviously, as a comedy and as a satirical comedy based in 1920s, it was based on a real life scandal, which it makes out it was nationwide. This scandal was mainly based in Littlehampton, and it involves Rose Gooding, who didn't come from Ireland, but in the film she did, played by Jessie Buckley, a wonderful actress. Well, she moves from Ireland to Littlehampton. She brings a child with her and says her husband had died in the war, the First World War, having been only a few years before. She lives with her partner Bill, played by Malachi Kirby, and gets on with her neighbour Edith Swan, played by Olivia Colman. A deeply conservative and religious person. Beware of such people in films because they do tend to be the baddies, and my goodness me, is she bad? Well, Edith, after the two of them have fallen out, starts receiving obscene letters, and gradually other residents of the Littlehampton do as well. Now, in the 1920s, there was nothing like, for example, if you received some ghastly letter, wouldn't you look at the handwriting? Well, such points, it's not the handwriting, it's the temper and style of living. It's the, if you're outrageous, if you, as Rose does, go to pubs, if you swear and shout, well, guilty, surely. And I mean, that is, of course, the movie shows a deeply meiotic patriarchal society, though oddly enough, not a racist one, which I thought rather surprising. Every other vice, but not racism, it's been written out of the script, and in my view, it would have been prevalent because if you have the characters that you have in this movie, I mean, for example, when Edith gets these dreadful letters, she reports Rose to the police, and Rose is facing losing custody of her child and imprisoned twice and so forth. This isn't as particularly a spoiler. It's perfectly obvious, though, that to make this a feminist movie is a step too far. Fair enough, police officer Gladys Moss, played by Arjana Varson, is daughter of a policeman who's highly regarded in the service locally, or was. The current officers are simply vile bigots, sort of Keystone Cops-like characters. They may well have been, but it is somewhat overdone, fair enough, but it's supposed to be a comedy. Equally, PC Moss isn't going to hang on to a job much longer because she believes that if you look at the letters that the unfortunate Edith and others have been receiving, or the way they do their G's is rather unusual, putting it mildly. What about comparing them? It's perfectly obvious who sent the letters. It doesn't, however, convince a court, but nonetheless, this movie starts to slip when it attempts, rather weirdly, whilst the cases are threatening her livelihood, she's sent to prison twice. Nonetheless, because I can only assume that it is a fact that Edith and Rose are women, there is a special bond between them, a sort of feminist bond. I make fun of it because simply it is absolutely ludicrous, and in reality I'm sure there was no such bond. The point, you see, is that the reason Edith is as she is, and she's a complete nutcase, is that the household is dominated by the brutal, violent, and abusive, a sort of human beast of her father. That's just played by Timothy Spall. Now, Timothy Spall is a very fine actor, but somebody has given him a ghastly face mask. And with this face mask comes, I mean, it's ludicrous. It's supposed to be a comedy, but not a comedy where the people are, in fact, not people. And I didn't believe in his character at all, since it would be impossible to create a more grotesque human being. Her mother is just simply anodyne and pious. And, well, when she receives one of the letters that Edith's been getting, well, she collapses and dies. Whose fault is that? The person who's been writing them. Well, the problem with the movie as well is that to catch her, and the way Edith was caught is true, but nonetheless, the way you see in this movie arguments in the street and the use of language that simply so many, the effing and blinding is absolutely dreary. You have a couple
It's
of
not
these.
Just the F word, it's the C word, it's a variety of other words, it's a whole stack of words, including the S word and more words.
No, and I mean, it's the words also in the letters you see enlarged and so forth. So, frankly, a movie that has a very good cast, including Eileen Atkins as a woman who believes that Rose is innocent, which indeed she is. Nonetheless, indictment of an era is particularly obvious, but the scenes are so contrived. And as I say, I mean, that Edith and Rose, in a weird way, never really seem to fall out because I can only assume that they are victims of the patriarchy. That doesn't work. This is not a good film. It is a wicked waste.
Well, wicked strange waste. That Mark Kermode would actually define it as the British comedy of the year. But then again, it is actually an hour less than June, so it's over. It's basically, if you want to just sort of chew it up, spit it out again, basically, it's just over 90 minutes, basically, in length. So you can easily sort of accommodate that and actually see it twice if you wanted to, or one June. However, I'm suspecting Richard might go for a three for this.
That's actually pretty good, two or three. It's certainly not going to get more in my book. It's a poor thing.
Wow. So let's go straight to Natasha, because obviously Australians known for their use of industrial and robust language and indeed the vernacular of dropping in the F-bomb on a regular basis. Is this something we should say? Well, if it's set in the 1920s and it's got Olivia Colman as a sweary individual and Jessie Buckley doing her own magical stuff, and it's a mere 90 odd minutes in length, it must be for me.
I mean, we are kind of known down here for being liberal with our language. I mean, the C word is often used as a sort of friendly greeting.
Yeah.
Look, I don't have a problem with bad language, but what I don't like is when it's just used for the sake of using it.
Gratuitous.
I feel like if you're going to use that sort of language, it needs to sort of have a point and have like add something to it. So for example, if it's in like a sort of a very like a gritty, I don't know, like a very sort of gritty police kind of outlawish kind of situation, and you've got that sort of language or a very working class sort of, like, I don't know, like if it fits the scene that it's in, I feel like it has a place and it enriches something because it gives you something about the people that are there or the situation. I feel like that's fine. If you're just using it because you want to be, I don't know, sort of over the top and sort of just for the sake of it. I don't like that. It's the same thing with the whole feminist movement. Like, if you're using feminism and you're sort of, if you're just using it to sell cinema tickets, I don't really want to know, because you're probably not going to use it in a way that's meaningful or going to add anything to the conversation. You're just going for a shock factor. So yeah, that's where I stand generally on that. I think it's an interesting, look, it's probably a very bad movie. I do feel like it's interesting, some of the comments Richard was making about how it's sort of, the religious people are sort of now being portrayed sort of as villains, and then contrasting that to the fact that the movie really isn't going to touch the racial matters. I think it's an interesting sort of reflection of where we're at as a society, that movie like that is being made, and maybe there's more to be picked apart from an anthropological sense. But actually, the movie itself, I'm probably not going to watch. I'm more interested in watching Damsel, which comes out at the end of the week. That will be probably my next review.
Well, as the strapline for Wicked Little Letters says, be careful what you post. Indeed so. In terms of that whole sequence, let's turn to obviously the politest member of the team, who would not endorse Smart Commode's line that swearing can be very liberating at all, because you never utter any profanities in any way, shape or form. Thea Vandenbogert, Wicked Little Letters. Something for yourself, or is it a case of no hard pass, even with Timothy Small in a mask?
Well, I watched the trailer, and I actually thought it seemed quite fun. I mean, yeah, there was a lot of swearing, but it seemed fun. But now I'm just like, oh, maybe it's too much swearing. I don't know. So no, it could have been a great movie, but I mean, if it's not good, yeah.
The swearing, I just emphasize that, I mean, I know I don't share Alex's particular detestation of swearing as per se. What I object to...
It shows a paucity of intellect, Richard.
Well, whether it does or not, Alex, it's just that the scenes, two particular scenes, that are so... I mean, some of the scenes are so bad, and then the scenes to see Olivia Colman swearing as she does, as Edith didn't do in the street, because they want her, you know, Olivia Colman swears, people would no doubt, or some people might, switch on part of the film. I mean, the facts simply are that it is not a good film, and it wastes an extremely good cast, and it is a promising subject for a satire.
Exactly. It had the potential, but they just didn't do it well. And maybe, yeah, there were a lot of factors that could have been better and just didn't happen.
I take it then, Richard.
Especially if you have Olivia Colman. I mean, she's such a great actress. Yeah, it's unfortunate.
But having said that, Radio Times, 5-star rating. Reader's Digest, 5-star rating. So clearly, there's an audience for Wicked Little Letters.
Oh, well, yes, clearly.
Okay, Richard, on to the Tate. What do you wish to share with us about the Tate and so on?
Well, the Tate has Sargent and Fashion. This is singer Sargent, portrait painter, who is remarkable, and indeed his portraits have a certain style, a certain cachet. He was the Van Dyck of the late 19th, early 20th century, the equivalent, and painted society portraits, most particularly the rich and the famous. And his use of fashion, and the fashions that you chose to be painted in, reflected your status in society and also reflected some of the beauties of that particular period and the social life. And it's therefore of interest that not only does the Tate Britain actually hang the portraits, but also in some cases anyway, it includes some of the dresses and fashionable items and so forth. It's a fascinating exhibition, since Sargent knew so well how to capture the character of the sitter, which is the way, or the main function of an artist, of a portrait painter. He was a high society favourite as an individual, as he was an extremely hard worker and somebody who left Paris in the 1880s for London after the famous scandal with Madame Coutreau. He painted her with a shoulder strap that was in fact
That is as bad as actually swearing in perpetuity, really. It's shocking, Richard.
Yes,
One shoulder strap as opposed to two shoulder straps. I'm shocked, Richard.
Every shoulder should have a strap, Alex. Yes, you're quite right. And the French made clear that they did not approve of the strap that fell down, so Sergeant had to alter it. But this became, of course, celeb, and no, he came to London, and he was very influenced by Gainsborough, by Velasquez, by Reynolds, the great old masters, and also, I mean, some of the portraits, Lady Agnew of Lochmore, the way she, you're transfixed, or I was transfixed by her gaze. It's really very, very impressive. And Lady Astor, a sort of swagger portrait size. I mean, that's absolutely magnificent. I mean, he painted the greats of his day, whether it was the artist Carolus Duran or the writer Henry James. And no question at all that this exhibition includes very large number of works, some showing a bit of gender bending, some of them informal, but the majority, the formal, the social and so forth, of a particular status, whether it was a vice regal or someone who was involved in the imperial rule in the East, or whether it was someone involved in the coronation. But the scale of it, the fact that these portraits draw you in. He had quite an impressionistic style, but the way he could capture the character, the way you see the person whilst looking at the portrait. I mean, I happen to be someone who isn't a great fan, to be perfectly honest, of models with dresses on them. The one occasion...
Sorry, Richard, do you prefer your models with dresses off them, then?
Well, Alex, I will clarify my comment, as I was going to do. The Jean-Paul Gaultier exhibition at the Grand Palais, that had the models with faces, with eyes, lips that appeared, it made them appear alive. Now that, as opposed to having the models with no head at all, and you just put the dress on, I find that, you know, in the portrait, the dress lives. It lives as an item.
They're quite literally losing their heads.
Well, it's, you know, if you're interested in the fashion, and I find fashion fascinating, I think that this will add an extra cachet to the exhibition. But as far as I'm concerned, it was the portraits that particularly fascinated me, because I've always admired Singer Sargent and his works. This is a great portrait artist, but there's also a charming room where he has little doodles, where he paints the same person twice in the same portrait or a picnic or whatever, and you see his work becomes surprisingly loose. The brush strokes flow. It's wonderful to see an exhibition like this, and also the fact that he was called the Van Dyck of his day, Van Dyck being the great 16th century portrait or painter who was Charles the First's propagandist, let's be honest. But what a fabulously talented figure. And here, I mean, you've got one of children, Carnation Lily, Lily Rose is a very famous one. I knew a lot of the portraits, some are in the Tate collection anyway, but they've got a wonderful selection, and anyone interested in portraiture should see it. If you find the models of the dresses and various other artifacts of the period diverting or interesting, so be it. But it's to see the work, and it's unmissable.
And how long does the exhibition last for, Richard?
I think it is the... Ah, I haven't got it with me.
Well, see if it's there. If you're lucky, it may well be. On the plus side, with respect to Wicked Little Letters, it does actually feature, at least in the trailer, Baccarat, that wonderful Spanish duet with Yes, Sir, I Can Boogie. In addition to that, of course, you could argue that's also set in a slightly later period, also based on a true story. The King's Speech also had a lot of swearing in it, but at the same time, maybe it was more in context. I'm just saying. Thea, are you looking forward to experiencing the... nearly 3 hours worth of Denis Villeneuve's classic Dune Part 2 with music by Hans Zimmer and more Would you be seeing it on an IMAX, a big screen? I mean, I think it's one of those rare occasions. I think you do need to see it on a big screen and then watch it, obviously, on your streaming phone afterwards.
Of course. You need to watch it on a big screen. It's just like James Bond. You have to see the real thing. That's just how you're supposed to watch it. And I've been looking forward to this film for over a year. So I'm very, very excited.
As I say, it's probably one of only two or three movies that will get me to the cinema these days. The other one, of course, will be Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes upcoming, and probably Mission Impossible 2. Other than that, it's much better to actually watch things on a small screen and actually experience them there. Oh, Natasha?
I really, this is heresy. I mean, this is driving people away from the cinema. This is a truly scandalous argument.
It's as bad as people saying that radio live broadcasting has no place in the world today. I mean, it's that kind of mentality. It's insane, Richard. You know, that's the sort of line that we're dealing with. However,
you are equating my views with heresy.
Natasha, from your own perspective, anything you'd like to say? Next week, we need to look at this animation movie.
I don't know, as I say, I'm going to do animated next week. I think I am very, very excited about the new version of Damsel that is coming out. I know it's a Netflix one. Sorry, Richard. I haven't really got a lot to work with right now. I've got a 10-week-old puppy. But I am very excited to watch that. And I hopefully will be reviewing that next week. And there's dragons. It's my ballpark.
And you've got, of course, The Gentleman that also opens up on Netflix as well with Vinnie Jones. I mean, I know, Richard, you're always a big fan of Vinnie Jones, and any Vinnie Jones movie is something which you feel essential for most listening, really, and viewing.
Well, very kind, Alex. Incidentally, it's the 7th of July, Singer Sergeant, so everyone should catch it if they can.
To Richard Fitzwilliams, to Pia Vandenberger, and to Natasha Wanton, huge thanks, as ever. And without swearing, keep watching those movies.
Bereavement is pretty tough at the best of times, and you might well say, yes, well, it's worse when it's human beings and so on. But actually, those of us who've actually suffered the loss of a pet can very much find ourselves still grieving many, many years after the event from that point of view. Indeed, there's an estimated 25,000 people supported annually with pet loss over the course of the last 30 years. Now, to talk us through some of the aspects within that and maybe actually share some of the systems that are actually available, we're delighted to welcome the head of pet loss support at the Blue Cross, of course. That's Diane James. How are you, Diane?
I'm very well, thank you.
Good. So, I mean, in terms of this, first of all, would you like to just share your own experience of losing a pet and how, in a sense, traumatic it was for your overall life experience?
Gosh, as a family unit, we've lost, sadly, numerous pets over the years. But the one that sticks in my mind was Ron the guinea pig. And he was my daughter's first pet. And she was absolutely devastated. She was six when he died. And he died in quite traumatic circumstances by death of another animal. I will say no more. And it really, really impacted on her. And it was her first experience of death. So it gave us the opportunity to be open and honest and explain to her what happens and set her up really for what sadly was to come with other pets.
And that's, again, one of the key aspects. I mean, I will remember, I think I was probably also maybe six or seven when Flash, our pet cat, actually passed away. I mean, thankfully, peacefully, but it was still difficult to kind of acknowledge and square that circle. And even, you know, obviously Tigger and one of our pet dogs as well, even a goldfish. So, you know, you do get attached to these companions who've allowed you to actually share their life experiences for a time. It's not a surprise that obviously we sense the grief process when that does actually occur. So let's talk about the other areas in terms of this survey. 48% of UK pet owners have actually silently endured grief after losing a pet. I mean, you mentioned a hamster. I'm sure people say, oh, a hamster, it's nothing. But equally, as I said, I mean, a goldfish, especially when they've lived for about 12 years, you tend to think, yeah, this is a big loss.
Do you know absolutely any pet? Because we get calls for absolutely everything from stick insects to chickens, right up to horses, dogs and cats. And the impact on everybody who goes through it is the same. We all suffer through grief differently, but the impact is huge no matter what the animal. And it's making people understand that the bond between human and animal is huge, because we socialise, we can rely on them as our only companion, they can be an integral part of our family life. So it's really important that people realise that it's a huge loss when it's a pet.
We were talking recently about how human beings have difficulty talking about making plans for bereavement or indeed coping with the system. There's almost a taboo about discussing the D word and so on. Is this something that actually what we're doing now effectively helps share the profile, and actually we do need to be able to communicate, even if it's a case of, you know, looking at sharing on social media?
Do you know, I think that as a nation, we do find death taboo, and talking about grieving or the loss of anybody, be human or animal. And I think if we can get it right with how we deal with pet loss grief, and we set people out on the route to understanding loss and being able to talk about it and normalise it, because that's a really important thing, is it is normal to grieve, and it's normal to grieve for a pet so that they don't encounter anything at all in work or with their friends. So it does become normal. We're setting people out ready for later losses.
I know in recent history, of course, there were many folk who were escaping from Ukraine. One of their most traumatic experiences was the fact that they were losing their pets, having to leave their pets behind. I mean, that's obviously a very extreme example. Are there ways in which, in essence, you know, we can acknowledge that even if it's a case of you're in a work environment and you say, well, I need time out because, our family pets just died, that actually a sympathetic ear is at the very least what's being provided?
Do you know, that's what we would love. We'd love every employer to be compassionate, because we understand that it's an impossibility to give paid bereavement leave for all animals. But if employers could be compassionate and in their handbooks perhaps mention services like Blue Cross Pet Loss Support being there, that it's a free service that's available, that we can support their employees, that would be a way to go on.
You gave this example, obviously, losing your own pet hamster, and also the way in which you connected with your children and the family with respect to that. Is there a way or any words of advice that you'd have for parents who might be listening to this at present or tuned in via a podcast or whatever, and they think, yeah, actually, how do I actually, in essence, share that, well, they've gone to a pet heaven, they've gone to this particular place, etc. Because it opens up, as I say, the whole essence of mortality and our own fragile existence.
Do you know it does? And I would emphasise everybody to be honest from the onset. Whatever your particular beliefs are, then you would follow that. But you wouldn't say, for example, they've gone to live on a farm or they've run away, because that really isn't the truth. And it then sets the child up to feel they were responsible. So we would say, please be honest. Obviously, be as truthful as you can as to how the end came or where they have gone. But also take the child's lead, because they are very resilient. So if they want to be a part of memorialising the pet, or even at the end of the pet's life, work with them, but just be honest.
Mm. And as head of pet loss support at the Blue Cross, are there any specific services that Blue Cross actually provides to actually help with supporting people who are grieving the loss of a pet?
We do. The actual support service itself has an awful lot out there. We open every day of the year from 8:30 to 8:30. People can contact us by telephone on 0800 096 6606, or they can email us on bluecross.org.uk/PLS, where they'll also find information for web chat, for Facebook, and a landing page if they have trouble emailing. So we've covered every eventuality, because we need to support more people out there, especially men who are grieving, I hasten to add.
I suspect I know the answer to this, but is there a specific time for grief to occur? Because I'm just citing an example, and clearly no names were mentioned here, where a family pet actually passed away and they kind of got replaced within 3 months. And the general thing was, that's a very rapid turnover. How can you have actually sort of even stopped the grieving process for the one who's passed before you actually get a replacement? I don't know. I mean, is that literally a case of, well, it's up to each individual person, each individual family, in essence, to decide when they consider getting a successor into the household?
Do you know, everybody grieves differently, and I would say that whatever's best for them, the most important thing is if you're part of a family unit or group, you discuss it as a whole and just don't turn up with a pet. It's really, really important that we do realise that it's going to be a unique, different pet, and I'd like to say rehoming is best here.
Yeah, I suppose cloning might be something we'd be considering in a few years' time, but I'm really not sure where we go with respect to that one, and could it ever really be the same? But that's by the by. Diane, it's been awesome sharing some thoughts with yourself. A reminder, of course, the easiest thing presumably is to just type in Blue Cross, and you'll get all the necessary details through the system.
You will, bluecross.org.uk/PLS, and you'll find everything to do with us there and also our amazing charity.
James, head of pet loss support at the Blue Cross. Many thanks indeed.
Thank you very much.
Siren Radio.
What a scenario without Siren Radio. Stand up, everyone, save our siren sound. From Lincoln to Miami, Paris to LA, our global community wants to hear it play.
Siren Radio.
Let them all create, students participate. Keep on keeping on, save our siren radio.